Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast in the New Books Network. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking to Professor Carlton F.W. Larson about his book, The Trials of Allegiance: Treason, Juries, and the American Revolution, published by Oxford University Press in 2019. Larson is a professor of law at the University of California, Davis School of Law. The Trial of Allegiance looks at the law of treason during the American Revolution, showing just how central treason is to understanding the course of the Revolution. Looking at Pennsylvania, Professor Larson provides readers with a comprehensive yet very readable study of treason prosecutions brought by Americans against non-patriots or non-rebels, depending on who you're asking at the time. Larson uses these trials and their aftermath to show how treason helped shape America's national identity during the Revolution. Professor Larson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So I guess to get things started off, can you tell our listeners how you became interested in this topic? Why did you decide to study it?
Well, this is something I've been interested in for a very long time, actually over 23 years now. It started out as a senior thesis in college. And become interested in the career of James Wilson, a signer of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And I'd read in a biography of him that he had defended persons who were accused of treason during the American Revolution by supporting the British. And the idea that a signer of the Declaration of Independence was, showing up in a courtroom as defense counsel to accuse traitors was just enormously fascinating. And it got me thinking more about, well, what did treason really mean during this time period when arguably everybody was potentially a traitor? Because if you remained loyal to Great Britain, you were potentially a treason, committing treason against the American states. But if you were loyal to the American states, you were potentially committing treason against Great Britain. And so I was fascinated by how the law played out during this very convoluted time period where allegiance was potentially shifting. And so that's how I got fascinated by it. And at the time, it was entirely of historical interest. It had really no contemporary relevance at all. In recent years, treason has become sort of hot again because of various events in the news. But my interest in it really was entirely historical. And then after I went to law school, I developed, I think, a better understanding of the law that was being employed. And then once I became a law professor and finally had tenure, I had time to sit down and really write the book the way I wanted it to be written.
And when you kind of get going in the book, and the title of the book is called Trials of Allegiance, but you introduce readers to this term and you provide them with a definition of what this means. And so can you give our listeners right now an idea of what you mean by Trials of Allegiance?
Sure. So in a very narrow sense, what it refers to is a set of trials where people are actually put on trial because of their allegiance. And so in the most formal sense, people are actually tried for the crime of high treason in a court, but there are also people who are tried for this in front of military tribunals or in front of committees of safety. who also heard some of these cases. But in a broader sense, I mean, trials refers to really just sort of the general problem that almost anyone living through this period had to deal with. It was a trial, not in the legal sense, but in the sort of the personal sense of a struggle that allegiance imposed very difficult choices on people in terms of which side they would ultimately support and what types of actions they could take without potentially running afoul of the law.
Yeah, and I mean, I think for a lot of readers of the book and, you know, just kind of who are interested in the American Revolution but might not have as much, you know, historical knowledge of it, you know, I think a lot of people forget that, you know, the American Revolution was really a civil war. And so when we're thinking about who is going to, you know, decide what side they're going to fight for, you know, that really is, as you've said, you know, a trial in and of itself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the American Revolution really it's our first civil war. And it's a civil war in many ways, just as much as the later one in the 1860s. You had large numbers of people who supported the British or who opposed independence or who opposed the new state governments for a variety of reasons. You had fathers fighting against sons and brothers against brothers. You had, you know, families completely ripped apart over this issue. And so in some ways, it was even arguably more of a civil war in the sense that it was divisive throughout the entire 13 colonies. Whereas arguably in the U.S. Civil War, there was more of a north-south split. Whereas here you had, you know, both sort of what we would now call ardent patriots and ardent loyalists throughout the entire country.
And so can you explain to our listeners some of the ways in which treason is fundamental to understanding the revolution? You lay out a number of ways in the book, and, you know, I don't expect you to go through all of them because, you know, we obviously want our listeners to pick up the book themselves. But can you give our listeners, you know, a taste of why this is so fundamental?
Sure. Well, at the very beginning, when people are arguing about British policies, you know, whether or not they are constitutional or not, and you start to get a certain level of American resistance, you end up having a significant debate about treason, in which British legal officials conclude that at least in some cases, certain American colonists had committed treason. And there is a suggestion that these people should be brought to Britain for trial. And this provokes an absolutely furious reaction on the American side of the Atlantic, by people who insist that, no, this is not treason. We are simply resisting arbitrary government in ways that are perfectly appropriate. And it's totally inappropriate for us to be sent to Britain for trial because we have the right to a trial by a jury of our peers. And that means a local jury right here in America. And then in this sort of very curious twist, they also begin arguing about that the British are actually the real traitors, that by violating certain understandings of the British Constitution, those people had committed treason. So the real traitors are British generals, the real traitors are members of Parliament or leading British officials, you know, perhaps even the king itself. And so that debate about sort of who is the real traitor tends to be a very significant part of the pre-war debate. And then once the war begins, it now becomes a very real moment where, you know, who is the enemy, who is the traitor, is not just sort of a matter of theoretical political disagreement, but potentially a matter of life or death when we have actual armies on the field. And then as we go through with the war, you know, the law of treason plays out in the same way in determining, you know, who has been consistent with their allegiance and who has not.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when thinking about it, I just find it so interesting, as you just, you know, said, that, you know, it goes from something that is, you know, kind of almost like high in the clouds, like, let's talk about the abstract principles of law, blah, 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 to something that is really like, okay, this is like actually something that can cost someone's life once the fighting really starts and you have armies on both sides, you know, marching through the colonies or independent states, depending on which side you are. You know, this is something where people really have to sit down and decide, what does this mean?
Yeah, and what particularly awkward about this period, really sort of between Lexington and Concord and the Declaration of Independence, is that you wanted to reach for the language of treason and say that the people who are supporting the British were traitors. And so people do make that rhetorical move. But it's a very awkward fit because the colonies hadn't declared independence from England. Formally, they were all allegiant to the king. Formally, people still owed allegiance to the king. And so it's very hard to say that, you know, the British soldiers or the people supporting them are somehow committing treason, unless it's actually the case that you don't really owe allegiance to the king anymore, which is, this, I think, sort of as a de facto matter was true once the war gets going.
And, you know, one of the parts of your book that is kind of takes center stage and that I found very interesting myself is the role of juries. And when we're talking about, you know, who's deciding, like, what treason is, what the law will be and everything like that, you know, that's one thing, like, who's making these laws. But as you point out, you know, the role of juries in actually convicting people cannot be overlooked, that this is a very important aspect of this. And so can you explain how juries fit into your study and why they're so important to understanding treason and the revolution more broadly?
Yeah, so I mean, juries were kind of central to much of the revolutionary ideology. And, you know, as I mentioned, the argument about being tried in Britain was seen as just fundamentally inconsistent with this idea of local control from a jury of your peers. And so one of the things that I've sometimes can be problematic with works in American history is we refer very generically to the jury or make some passing reference to a person being convicted or acquitted. But that obscures the actual agency of the jurors themselves. And so one of the things I wanted to do in the book was to take a really close look and see how juries actually functioned during the revolution. How were these jurors selected? What types of people served on the jury? What can we figure out about their deliberations to the extent that we can? And then what does that tell us about how this institution actually operated? And one of the reasons I got fascinated by this was I started looking at the jury lists for a series of trials in Pennsylvania. And this was back when I was working on the college thesis. And one of the things I noticed was you tended to see the same names over and over again. And it wasn't the case that, you know, it was the identical juries. They were different for each person. But certain people seemed to be serving over and over again. And so that struck me as fascinating. And so I started, you know, just running the numbers and figuring it out. And it turned out you have a small number of significant repeat jurors who continually served. And so what I then did was essentially sort of reverse engineered jury selection to the extent I could to figure out why some of the people were serving over and over again. And when you do that, what you end up coming down to is this institution of peremptory challenges where you can simply, a litigant can simply challenge a juror for no particular reason, but they simply say, I don't want that person on the jury. And for these treason trials, you had 35 peremptory challenges for the defense, and the prosecution got zero, which for modern lawyers is very hard to understand because in modern trials, we have equal numbers for the prosecution and the defense. But that wasn't the case then. And so the defense was able to use these peremptory challenges in ways that they thought would benefit the defense. So it seems that they preferred older jurors, they preferred jurors with English ethnicity, they preferred jurors who hadn't personally performed their militia service, they preferred Anglican and Quaker jurors over, say, Presbyterian jurors, and they preferred generally wealthy jurors over poorer jurors. And so it seems like in so doing, they were trying to construct a jury that would in some ways be more beneficial to the defense along some of the axes that historians have pointed to as lines of division in society at this time.
And so if we're thinking about what treason looks like at this time, can you explain to our listeners what treason is thought about and what it looks like by the eve of the revolution. You know, once things are kind of, you know, starting to, you know, kick off with, you know, the protests and everything like that, what is the kind of colonial understanding of treason at this time?
So there's an English statute of treasons enacted in 1351 during the reign of Edward III, and that's sort of the foundation of English treason law. And so by the time of the revolution, that law had been around for over 400 years. It had been the subject of significant commentary by various English judges and treatise writers. So there's a fairly sort of shared professional understanding, at least among lawyers, as to what treason was and wasn't. There were some debates on some issues, but the basic contours of it were all shaped by this statute. For colonial Pennsylvanians, and Pennsylvania is the state I focus on here, there was some debate as to what extent that statute fully applied in the colony, and that was a debate in other states as well. So some contentions were that certain types of treason could only be committed in the realm of England, for example, and there were questions as to whether revolts against Pennsylvania's proprietary government counted as treason against the king. So those issues were lurking. And then when once the revolution happens and the American colonies have to draft their own treason laws, they're largely drawing on, this body of English treason law as it was, sort of understood and conveyed. There's obviously significant changes. It's no longer a crime, treason to compass the death of the king. But we ultimately end up with, say, in our U.S. Constitution are these phrases, adhering to the enemy, giving them aid and comfort, or levying war against the United States. And those phrases actually come directly from the 1351 Statute of Treasons.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so we've already mentioned you've already mentioned once about how the colonists and, you know, the soon to be independent Americans are trying to formulate their own understandings of treason. And so one of the things that I found very fascinating was your discussion about how Americans are trying to deal with imperial officials accusing them of treason and trying to, you know, work out a logic of why they're not committing treason. So what does that look like?
Yeah, so that's, you know, essentially, I think, part of the source of why we ultimately have a treason provision in the U.S. Constitution, which is meant to be a restrictive provision. And one of the things that, you know, the revolution has experienced was that their resistance activities have been labeled treason by British officials, and they just fundamentally rejected that idea, that whatever we're doing is simply not an act of treason. And I think it's a debatable point under English law whether some of it was or wasn't. I don't think it was completely crazy for British officials to reach the conclusions that they did. But by this point, there really did seem to be a divergence, at least on certain issues, as how it was perceived in Great Britain and how it was perceived in the American colonies. And so that experience, I think, is why ultimately in Article 3 we end up with this more narrow division. It's not so much that there were debates during the war about whether certain things constituted adhering to the enemy or not. It was more that prior to the war, there had been the threatened use of treason law to go against essentially political dissenters. And it was that concern that I think animated Article 3.
And I know from my own personal experience and kind of researching stuff during this time period, you know, one of the things that I would think would be kind of culprit number one for a British official to accuse of treason would be, you know, committees of correspondence or committees of safety that are basically running the show for a large part of time before actual fighting kicks off and kind of acting as pseudo governments in a way.
Yeah. So one of the things that the British find to be treason is this meeting of the Massachusetts Provincial Conference in 1774, that and essentially arming a colonial militia, that these were perceived as acts of treason, and they actually name names, the British legal officials as to who they intended to bring back to Britain for trial.
And so I think a lot of listeners would probably be familiar if we're talking about this topic and thinking that, oh, the signers of the Declaration of Independence were committing treason. You know, we always kind of see this pop up during like the 4th of July, where it's just like, look at what these people are doing. You know, they are taking their own lives in their hands and everything like that to sign this document. And one of the things that you point out in your book is that while the Declaration of Independence is obviously important, if we're thinking about treason from the colonial slash American point of view, that the Declaration doesn't actually mark a point of departure. And so where do you find that point, and how does the Declaration actually fit into that story?
Yeah, so I actually think that this the mere signing of the Declaration of Independence, it's possible, actually wasn't an act of treason under English law, because you might imagine a group of people just get together, they sign some document declaring themselves independent, and then absolutely nothing comes of it. That, in the absence of any actual force being used, might not be treason. But obviously, the people who signed the Declaration had done a lot more than that. They had, you know, supported and equipped an army, and they had done all kinds of things that were treasonous. So the way the Declaration of Independence intersects with treason law on the American side is, prior to the Declaration, we had these people who were aiding the British army as against the American army. And everybody called them traitors, and there were trials for what was called treason in front of committees of safety. But none of those committees felt that they could impose the death penalty. That is, the people who were convicted were all imprisoned. And the thought was, it simply cannot be treason until there's actual formal independence. And so with adoption of the Declaration of Independence, it's now possible to make treason a capital crime. And some of the people at the time justified the Declaration of Independence for precisely that reason, that it would now allow capital punishment to be visited on the British adherents. So one of the people who says that is Thomas McCain, the Chief Justice of Pennsylvania. There's another line in the book from, I think it was a man in Massachusetts, who says, you know, this most important reason for the Declaration of Independence was cutting off the Tories, that it now makes a treason prosecution principled and coherent in a way that it just wasn't before, so long as the colonies were technically loyal to the English crown.
And for me, I find that so interesting in that, you know, sometimes, you know, at least from like a historical standpoint, you look at the Declaration of Independence and in terms of like its legal weight, you know, sometimes there's not much of it depending on the situation. But here, as you're showing, you know, the Declaration is actually really important for what Americans can do when it comes to treason. And, you know, what they can do with treason is actually really important for the cause itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, kind of going back to juries that we've, you know, kind of touched on before, and you were kind of talking about the composition of juries earlier. But could you tell our listeners, you know, what usually happened with these juries? You know, you kind of hinted that, you know, the defense is trying to get something favorable for them, but does it work? And, you know, if it does, what does this show us about the revolution and treason itself?
Yeah, so one of the things I find most striking about these jury trials in Pennsylvania is that pretty much all the defendants are acquitted. And this is really quite extraordinary if you think that, you know, Philadelphia had been occupied by the British army. It had been a, you know, difficult occupation. The people who were, you know, were particularly loyal to the U.S. had all fled. And then ultimately the British army left. And so the Americans reconquered the city, and people who had aided the British are put on trial, for treason. One wouldn't expect, again, in this midst of this violent, deadly civil war, that juries would look with much favor on people who are accused of doing that. But again and again and again, they do. They acquit, and in the, at least in the series of Philadelphia trials, the two cases where they convicted, almost all the members of the jury petitioned the Supreme Executive Council, which was the state's plural executive, for clemency. And so I found this all very puzzling. You know, why was this? And I think the answer to that is the death penalty. That is, the jurors simply did not think that the death penalty was an appropriate punishment for treason, even in the midst of this civil war that potentially put them all at risk. And here, the jurors seem to be treating treason differently than they did other capital crimes like murder or burglary or rape. That this was something just different, because the underlying crime was fundamentally a political crime. It was a crime of political disagreement. And that meant that the person who did it wasn't necessarily an incorrigible, evil criminal, but someone who could potentially be redeemed. And moreover, was somebody that the jurors could potentially understand as someone similar to them, because pretty much every juror knew someone who had joined the other side, be it a family member or a friend or a business associate. It wasn't so easy to paint the other side as essentially, you know, incorrigible devils. And so there's this sense that what to do with these people is convict them, maybe take their property, maybe imprison them, but not to hang them. And so with the earliest cases, that was the sense as well. We could convict them, and then they'll get a pardon. But Pennsylvania's government didn't do that. And they let two people be executed. This was a very divisive thing. And pretty much every jury after that refused to convict, even in cases where the evidence of guilt was probably pretty clear, because they simply didn't trust the state government anymore not to hang a person who was convicted. And so in this way, the pattern of trials is different than that in other states, where in other states it seems that there were more convictions for treason. But then most people were ultimately pardoned. But because the Pennsylvania jurors didn't trust their government to actually carry through with pardons, they just went ahead and outright acquitted.
And for me, I find it so interesting to think about this because, you know, at least when it comes to Pennsylvania, it kind of shows the limits of kind of revolutionary ideology, at least to me, in terms of showing how, you know, how far the kind of radicalism of the American Revolution, to take a term that we kind of see in history, at least, how far that would go. Because as you're showing, like, people are saying, okay, like, yeah, there, this might be treason, but, you know, we're going to treat this differently. And to me, I mean, to me, that's like a really important contribution that you're making there.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, it is true. Like the American Revolution is not the French Revolution. It's not the Russian Revolution, right? I mean, it doesn't end in this, you know, just horrible bloodbath. I mean, there's fighting, obviously, with the armies. But in terms of, you know, some type of civilian purge, I mean, that's just simply not the case. What people ended up going in front of juries, they had very good defense counsel on their behalf. and the juries were ultimately receptive to their arguments. And I think that shows sort of, in some ways, you know, a commitment to legal process, to doing this the right way, even if the results were maybe perhaps not what the state wanted. But that's how we're going to do things. And I think that matters, right? That, you know, even in time of war, to the best extent we can, we're going to follow existing law and existing legal procedure.
And, you know, you just mentioned there that, you know, these people, in terms of, you know, the trial going on, they have access to really good defense counsels. And you kind of opened up in terms of like how you got interested in this. And this situation actually opens up your book, but you return to it. Something that I think a fair amount of people might not be familiar with. I know I wasn't, but the battle, quote unquote, of Fort Wilson. And so you use this to talk about, you know, the kind of aftermath of trials. And so how does this battle kind of typify the sort of response that you see from the wider public to these treason trials?
Yeah. So one of the things I uncovered is that this string of acquittals that, you know, many of these lawyers had managed to procure was not popular. 1779 opens up, Pennsylvania goes into a, you know, really quite bad economic times, and there is unbelievable bitterness that, you know, these acquitted defendants are wandering around, and people think that the juries have not done what they were supposed to do. And so there's extensive criticism of juries in the newspapers. There is an attempt to interfere with a what's called a misprision of treason trial in the city court. And then finally, sort of all this resentment erupts in what's called the Battle of Fort Wilson. And this is, I think, really one of the most extraordinary events of the American Revolution. So that's why I chose it to open the book. And this is a few days after James Wilson won another acquittal for a treason defendant, this time with the courtroom back in what's now Independence Hall. He is in his house with a number of other folks, and he's under attack. There are militiamen in the streets beating the drums and firing at his house, and people in the house are firing back. And at the end of this battle, you know, 6 or 7 people are dead. It's ultimately put down by a group of cavalry unit. But this is one of the few sort of instances of, you know, outright urban warfare, right in the city of Philadelphia itself during the Revolution. And what's particularly horrifying about it is it's not Americans fighting the British. It's Americans fighting Americans, in part over this issue of treason and what should be done with the people who remain loyal to Britain. So Wilson almost loses his life in this incident. And so in many ways, it's surprising that it's not more well known, although I guess I understand why it's not well known. It's not one of those events that really has any obvious heroes. And it's really quite embarrassing, actually, to sort of a nicer narrative about the Revolution. So I can see why, you know, it's perhaps not highlighted in, you know, many accounts of the Revolution. But it is, you know, I think it reveals a lot about how this event played out.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I was, you know, first reading about it, I was, you know, at first I was just like, wait, what is going on here? You know, and partly because I wasn't aware of how much, you know, Wilson would have been disliked for any number of things, particularly, you know, this treason trial, because for me, you know, I'm most familiar with Wilson being in the Constitutional Convention, creating the Constitution, and being, you know, complimented so much and praised so much for being like one of, if not the most educated lawyers of the time, which kind of leads into my next question of how does this whole revolutionary experience with treason and the ideas that are forming during it, and you've kind of already hinted at this, how does this affect the eventual adoption of the Constitution?
Yeah, so I think it it does shape it. And partly it's because, you know, some of the players were there. So James Wilson is generally considered probably the person most responsible for the inclusion of a treason clause in the U.S. Constitution. And, you know, it wasn't a thing that in any state constitution had a definition of treason. In England, it was done by statute. Granted, it was a very old statute, but Parliament was constantly tinkering with it and passing new statutes dealing with treason. So here we had an effort to essentially say treason is off limits to the Congress. This is the definition, and that's it, and no more. And I think that basic idea that it should be set aside from politics and from changing vagaries of political life very much bears Wilson's imprint. Now, the precise details of it, I think, probably bear the work of some other hands as well. But Wilson, in later instances, like in the Pennsylvania Ratifying Convention, singled out the treason clause for special praise. And so I think he, related to this in a very, very personal way, right? And this was someone who had defended treason cases in about the most volatile political environment you could possibly imagine. And of course, almost lost his life in having done so. And Wilson, as you know, of course, very educated lawyer, and I think that stood him in good stead at the Constitutional Convention. It probably didn't stand him in particularly good stead during the Battle of Fort Wilson, I think, precisely because he was an educated lawyer, and because he had a reputation, I don't know how well deserved or not, for arrogance, he was not a soldier. He was probably perceived by, certain members of the Pennsylvania militia as not truly one of them. And then, of course, we know very little about Wilson generally, because even after he helps draft the Constitution, he's a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, but then ends up dying after having several instances of being in debtor's prison and essentially on the run from his creditors. And so it was a very sort of unfortunate end. But to me, still one of the great fascinating lives of the Revolution. And, we still don't have any modern biography of James Wilson, which I think is truly a stunning gap, because his life is as interesting as that of almost anyone. And like Alexander Hamilton, he's an immigrant. He comes from Scotland. In his 20s.
And so, you go on after, speaking about all of this to talk about how, briefly how treason operates in the new nation. However, I definitely want our listeners to turn into readers. And so I'm going to encourage you all to go buy this book, again, The Trials of a Legion, Treason, Juries, and the American Revolution, to find out how this story ends, and then also the kind of finer details of the history that we've just painted for you. But we have this book in our hands, and hopefully, we've either read it or we're buying it, but we have it. And so what can we expect from you in the future? What might you be working on now? And it is completely okay, given that this just came out earlier this month, if I'm remembering correctly, that if you just say, I'm taking a break right now.
Well, it would be nice to be taking a break right now, but I actually have a second book coming out on treason. And it's fine. Just before this interview started, I actually got copies of what the covers, proposed images of what the cover might look like. And so this book is called Treason, A Concerned Citizen's Guide to the Law. And this grew out of essentially the last couple of years in which treason is no longer a matter just of historical interest, but people have lots of questions about whether treason is being committed even as we speak. And so I wrote this book as a very much sort of, for non-lawyers, but sort of to translate some of the legalese of treason law, and also to tell the stories of some fascinating treason trials in American history, beginning in the period after the Trials of Allegiance end. So picking up stories like Aaron Burr and Jefferson Davis and Kastner-Hanway and the Resistance of the Fugitive Slave Act, Tokyo Rose, characters like that. And so it's been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot more about treason law while working on that project.
Well, I encourage all of our listeners to go out and buy that book as well. Like Professor Larson just told us, treason is no longer sort of a just kind of historical topic, but it is something that I think a lot of people should learn about. And so I encourage you not only to go out and buy this book, but go out and buy Professor Larson's next book as well. And so in any case, thank you very much for coming onto the program today.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.